So our last topic here is imprisonment. And I brought you a couple of articles here that I think illustrate the problem. We've learned that establishing a police force is a religious duty. We have said that the Torah tries to rein in the police by presenting them as agents of God with that type of a responsibility and not agents of human being, although we noted that being an agent of God is open to abuse. People can claim that they're doing all sorts of things in the name of God, and people have claimed that. We've learned that Judaism trusts officers to use force properly by definition of the position or because of practical necessity or to trust of those who would take on that that role. They can be tried and punished for wrongdoing, but you know, the default is to trust them. So the question now is, what about jail? Where does Judaism prescribe jail? Does it view jail as punishment, as deterrent, as rehabilitation? So the two articles that I brought you here in 13 and 14 speak to the problem that we face. Number 13, Justin Ling, Canada's prisons are failing. From the CBA, the Canadian Bar Association. It has been more than 80 years, he said in 2019, since a government-ordered report into the conditions inside Canada's prisons recommended nothing less than radical change. And he goes on to say that the study would reject a system built on retribution and punishment and ensure, quote, the reformation and rehabilitation of all those who find their way into our prisons. And he says the better part of a century later, there are worries that the wisdom of that report has been lost. Meaning, the goal of a prison system should not be retribution, but should be rehabilitation. And he says, I'm not seeing it. In June 2016, correctional investigator Howard Safers released his final report after more than a decade in the job. In it, he describes a system at a breaking point. And the parts that I skip are not because they're not valuable, it was just a space issue. I recommend going to the website. Those who are on the email list for the class, you can just click the link that I gave you on the sheet. I will send it out with the follow-up email from today. If anyone is not on the email list, just give me your address, please. In that report and in the litany of studies he published, Sapers describes a system that has steadily turned away from rehabilitation, favoring longer and longer sentences, that has become tougher on Indigenous offenders and those with mental health issues. It's a system that has employed solitary confinement as a matter of convenience for the prisons or as a way to cover resource shortages. It's a steep indictment when you read the report. The CBC has a report, which I quote here in number 14. Their focus in this report is on creative methods of rehabilitation, but they note some statistics here in the piece that I brought. A 2015 John Howard study on the Ontario prisoner population revealed that more than 40% reported experiencing mental health issues. 70% said they had problems with substance abuse. Self-reporting, obviously. The isolation of prison can exacerbate these struggles, a CAMH report says, as CSE, Corrections Services Canada, is the sole health care provider for all offenders. Their choices are limited. A U.S. Justice Department document states that rehabilitation and treatment programs have an effect on recidivism, right, preventing or helping to prevent at any rate repeating, ranging from 10 to 20%. I'm not sure if that number is being held up as good or bad. I'm impressed you got anything. But that's what they're saying, that the rehabilitation treatment programs are succeeding. I wouldn't call it useless, but yeah, it's not what we want it to be. Lack of mental health support, lack of help for people dealing with addictions. And this is not just Canada. Don't kid yourself. I mean, I'm not picking on Canada. You can go south of the border. You can go anywhere you want in the world, basically. And you find similar statistics and similar problems. So what does a Jewish system look like? So it's really striking. What crimes in the Torah earn a punishment of prison? Diane says none. We don't have a prison system. It doesn't exist. Take a look at number 15, please. I built a table for you just to try to present this very simply. Three columns. First column, what are the penalties in the event that somebody breaks a law or harms somebody else by accident? So if they break a law between them and God, there may be a korban, a sacrifice to bring. I don't like the word sacrifice. It's not really a good translation of the word korban. It is an offering in which one takes of one's own and says, I am going to give this to God, so to speak. Not that God needs it, but that people need to give. In the event that it's harm against somebody else, there's financial restitution, right? I mentioned the principle before. Adam mu'ad la'olam. A person is always considered forewarned. You can't say, I didn't know. You damage somebody's property, I don't care that it was a mistake, you're still liable to replace it. In the event that the crime is committed intentionally, but we don't have the witnesses, or there wasn't the proper warning, they can say, I didn't know. I didn't know what the penalty was. I didn't realize what I was doing was illegal. Whatever. So if it is a sin against God, there is generally, almost always, no korban to be brought. Meaning the sacrificial system is only meant for cases in which a person broke the law by accident and now wants to atone. If they broke it on purpose, you don't have the right to just say, well, I want to bring a sacrifice and have that wiped off of my record. There are a couple of unique cases where there is an offering, but generally not. Instead, there is what I translate here as divine excommunication, which in Hebrew is called, anyone know?
Cherem.
Not cherem. No. Karet. Karet, literally lichrot, is to cut off, to sever. It's often translated as excision, which is a painful sounding word. But divine excommunication means God says, I want nothing to do with this person.
All those sins that
it's mentioned on Yom Kippur, yes. It applies to certain cases of sexual crimes. There are certain crimes that warrant this. There are actually 36 altogether that qualify for this penalty. And it's not one that a court is carrying out. This is God carrying it out. You don't have witnesses. You don't have a warning. How are you carrying anything out? Also, what's called in Hebrew, mitah bidei shamayim, divine execution, meaning God may take that person. Again, not carried out by a court. It's just an understanding that God will take care of it. If they sin against a human being, then again, they may have financial liability for what they've done wrong. I wrote liability instead of restitution, but it's actually the same. I didn't mean to make a distinction there in the chart. I should change that. And then the last column is intentional lawbreaking with witnesses and a warning, the whole bit. Again, no korban. If they break a low-level law, they may get lashes. Not fun. And that's its own discussion about how that's carried out. It would have been great to get to that in this series, but it's just not going to happen. The same business of divine punishments that God carries out. And then for certain things, there is a death penalty. Death penalty is very hard to actually carry out within Judaism. The Torah actually states that the judges on the court, there are 23 judges on this case, are responsible to try to find the defendant innocent. The Torah says, "V'hitzilu ha'eda et harotzeach," that the judges are actually supposed to try to find for innocence. However, there is, at least on the books, the possibility of a death penalty. But nowhere in this table do you see prison. 7 to 9 years, or 40 months, or whatever the case may be, it's simply not here. We do find certain cases, biblically, in which people were imprisoned. In source number 16, I gave you the references. We actually discussed these cases back in our first and second week when we were talking about the role of the police. So the first case was Exodus 21:19. That's a law where somebody assaulted somebody else and were waiting to find out whether the victim died. So then you will arrest the person who was the assailant in order to hold them pending determining whether this was a murder or an injury. So clearly they had to have some place where they watched him. Presumably it's something makeshift because you don't have an ongoing prison system. So somebody figures out a place to put him. Literally the Torah's term is mishmar, a place to guard him. Yeah. The other two cases that I brought you in number 16 are cases involving people who committed specific acts in the Torah, and the Jews didn't know what to do, and waited for Moses to go back to God and ask him, what do we do here? And so, again, it's a makeshift thing. He's just being watched to to make sure he doesn't go anywhere while we figure out what's supposed to happen. I don't know where he would have gone in the wilderness anyway. Nonetheless, that's the way that they address it. And then the other case that comes up biblically is the case that we've mentioned off and on, which is the Ir Miklat. And that one deserves some discussion. You're going to say that? Yes. Ir Miklat. Ir Miklat is what? What is it translated as in English usually? City of refuge. Who is it for? Not quite. Accidental murder. However, and here's where I come back to the question that Sandy asked about degrees of murder. There are different kinds of accidental murder. Meaning, you have the person who absolutely had no way of knowing that their actions were going to lead to this person's death. They don't go to a city of refuge. That's not for them. You have somebody who, from everything we can see, seems to have done this intentionally, but we can't prove it. And that person is also not entitled to the city of refuge. City of refuge is specifically where it was deemed an accident, where the court can determine this was indeed accidental. There are four purposes to sending someone to a city of refuge. Why would you do it? Protection from the family, right? That's number one on our list, is protection, which is why we don't extend it to the person who everybody knows did it on purpose, we just can't prove it. That person does not have the right to this protection, and doesn't apply to the case in which it's clear that it was an accident, because we expect within society that you're not going to come after somebody where it was clear that this had, that there was no intent, that there was nothing you could have done, it just happened, because unfortunately that things like that do happen. Aside from protection, what are the other motivations for sending someone to a city of refuge? So there is some element of punishment to this. What else? Yes, Moshe.
Well, it's very much a matter of both of a culture from tribalism, where people just look after whoever killed their family, to move into something neutral form, which has extreme values, but it's something that will evolve even beyond that. But the key thing is ending tribalism within the nation.
I don't understand. How does the city of refuge do that?
There's an automatic place of refuge where the tribe that wishes to act cannot act.
So what we're doing is we're preventing the family from attacking. Right.
Yes.
Okay. Part of that protective element. What else, Effie?
When somebody goes to a city of refuge, does he go on his own or can he take his family?
Family can go with.
They can. Okay.
Family can go with. As a matter of fact, his rabbi is obligated to go with him.
His rabbi?
Yeah. The guy's got to learn Torah. Rabbi's got to go to the city of refuge also. Sorry?
What about the rest of the community that needs to learn Torah also?
They should go learn from him there. No, in all seriousness, this is a major disruption to the community. They can. City of refuge was not what people sometimes imagine, where it's just a town populated by murderers. You know, everyone's sort of walking around the street and asking, so what are you in for? It was actually one of the Levite cities. The Levites had 48 cities, of which six of them were designated for cities of refuge. And they lived there. That was their normal city.
So
these are their cities. And the answer is the law, right? The law prevents the pursuer from coming after him. But you're right. I mean, theoretically, you wonder. But take a look on the sheet here, number 17 and 18, from the Sefer HaChinuch, this book that collects the 613 mitzvot and tries to provide some explanation and commentary to each. So there are multiple mitzvot that relate to this city, but the Sefer HaChinuch, in his commentary, offers some added explanations for the value of the city of refuge. Because the sin of murder is very severe, involving destruction of the world, to the point where the sages said, one who kills intentionally will never be saved from justice, even if he performs every mitzvah. Therefore, it is appropriate that one who kills, even accidentally, because such a great tragedy happened at his hand, should be pained by exile, which is almost as painful as death. One is separated from his friends, the land of his birth. He lives out his life among strangers. Even if family chooses to move with him, fundamentally, he's been uprooted from everything he knew. So there is a punitive element within this. This law also improves the world, as the text, biblical text clarifies, for the murderer will thus be saved from the redeemer of the blood of the victim, lest he kill him without guilt on his hands, for he did this accidentally. So, second element, protection. There is another benefit, in that the relatives of the victim will not need to see the murderer before their eyes perpetually in the place where the evil was done. Right? The idea here is, if you're going to leave him where he was, for all you know, and especially if you consider it was an accidental murder, it could have been his neighbor, somebody down the street, somebody who the family got to see this guy in shul. That's not, you can't do that. Send this guy away. The ways of the Torah are pleasant. And then in number 18, you get an added element, which is the rehabilitation. Because of the great level and fine conduct and fine value of the Levites. Any Levites here? Yeah, we got some Levites. Okay. Great level, fine conduct, fine value of the Levites. Their land was chosen over the land of the other tribes to absorb any who kill accidentally. Perhaps the land invested with their sanctity will atone for him. So in other words, there's holiness to the Levites and where they live. But there's also another reason for this. Because the Levites are thoughtful people. Known to be versed in the levels of character and honor and wisdom, it is known that they will not reject this murderer who will take refuge there. They will not harm him, even should he kill one of their friends or kinsmen, for he will have killed suddenly without enmity. They're not going to hold it against him. We look at the Levites as an ideal society for this person. They can... Sorry? Yeah. Because there's one in every bunch. Every family's got something.
It always bothers me when in the blessing of Yaakov, I don't know why it's called blessing, but that Shimon v'Leviachim
claim because he's talking about what they did.
B'sadam al tavo nafshi.
Nachon. Ruchama points out, and it's true, that the heritage of the Levites is mixed, meaning that they had a track record biblically that was not entirely on the up and up. Yeah, but their sin is not a sin against other people. There's violence in their record. This is very true. Nonetheless, that's the ideal, and that's what's being proposed, is that they are a better place for this person to live for rehabilitation than staying home. Than staying within society. So biblically, what you're seeing here is a system which has temporary imprisonment that we define in certain very specific cases where you need to determine a verdict, where you need to prevent flight. And then you have this city of refuge. At the same time, you have this city of refuge, which presents, yes, a punitive element. He has to leave home. He has to go live there. But number one, he's living in a city. He's not in jail. He's not, confined to a cell. And number two, you have all of these other motivations, including the rehabilitative element of learning from the Levites. Now, I have to state, I'm sorry to cut off questions now, but I'm looking at the time and recognizing where we have to get to. You have rabbinic institutions of imprisonment as well. So I'm going to say it outside of the text, but you can see it here in 19 and 20. Maimonides codifies it. If you have somebody who cannot pay a debt, there's no such thing in the Jewish system as debtor's prison. If someone can't pay his debt, he does not go to jail. However, if you know that he has the means to pay, everybody knows this is a guy who just evades his responsibilities under the law, then the courts are indeed empowered to imprison him. They're able to excommunicate him. They can do what they feel is necessary in order to get him to pay his debt. And not only that, but I mentioned before, you could have a case in which somebody commits murder and you don't have witnesses or you don't have a warning, but everybody knows this was on purpose. So Maimonides writes in number 20 that if you have somebody who arranges somebody's death and just does it in a way that the courts aren't going to be able to try him, the court is able then to strike him, the court is able then to imprison him. So you have an extra biblical power that's assigned to the courts. He talks about a hitman. He talks about all sorts of cases there in number 20. What emerges is that imprisonment is not a standard penalty, but it may be applied anyway by a rabbinical court. Now, I would love to turn this into a conversation, but I won't be able to, just because I want to get through in time. But the justifications for giving a court this license to invoke imprisonment where the biblical text does not present it is, I think, threefold. Number one, it's still in the hands of ordained judges, meaning this isn't something that anybody gets to do. Number two, there is a biblical mission, and I brought you verses 4 to number 21, in which society is commanded to eradicate evil from your midst. It is warned. We are told to prevent the perpetuation of evil conduct in our midst. That first verse that I quote you in number 21 is in the context was talking about where witnesses come to testify against somebody, and it is determined that it was actually a false incrimination, where they invented the testimony to try to use the court system in order to harm an innocent person. So they receive whatever penalty they try to get this person to have. It's called in Hebrew edim zomamin, and the Torah says in order to prevent the perpetuation of evil conduct. So I have a responsibility to eliminate evil, and that is the second rationale for having imprisonment, even if the Torah did not legislate it. And then the third, and I think the main justification for it, is that society can't survive on the basis of the Torah's laws and punishments alone. And this goes back to what you were saying, Moish, about the credibility of police officers before, and the credibility of people within the system of power. But Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Adered, in sources 22 and 23, says it. If you're going to rely on a system that says we can't punish somebody unless we had witnesses and a warning and all of that, then you really have removed the teeth from your system. It means that people will know just how they can get away with whatever they want to do. And so what you need is a degree of flexibility within the system, and therefore, so long as your imprisonment doesn't actually violate laws of the Torah, the court may well be empowered to institute it. But it wasn't a standard penalty. That's, to me, the most fascinating takeaway from this, is that it's not there within the system. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi was a rabbi in Israel, middle of the 20th century. We have quoted him from time to time. And he wrote an article called Onesh HaMaasar BaHalacha, The Penalty of Imprisonment in Jewish Law. And he argued that there's a reason why prison, specifically, taking away a person's liberty, is not in the normal canon of biblical penalties. He says it's because imprisonment is wrong. There's a biblical text that says, Ve'asita hayashar ve'hatov, you shall do that which is righteous, that which is just, and that which is good. And he says, you know, not everything that is righteous and just is also good. As an example, he quotes his source number 24, a story in the Talmud involving a sage who had wine barrels. He hired some porters to carry the wine barrels. They broke the barrels. He says, hey, you robbed me of my wine. And he grabs their cloaks to hold, waiting for payment from them. They complained to Rav, a leading sage of the time. Rav says to Rabba Bar Bar Hanan, who is the owner of the wine, he says, give them back their cloaks. He says, is that the law? They stole my wine. And Rav says, yes. What do you mean? He quotes you a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, so that you will walk the path of the good. In other words, no, letter of the law is you have the right to demand restitution. However, I don't want you to demand it. I want you to give them back the cloaks. This is the good thing to do. But it gets better. The porters then said, you know, we're poor. We worked all day thinking we were going to be able to eat that way, right? We didn't get paid. We're hungry. We have nothing because we lost the entire day already. Rav says to Rav Bar Hanan, you pay them for the work. He says, is that the law? And he says, quotes the rest of the verse from Proverbs, and you will guard the path of the righteous. In other words, this is what's called in Hebrew, lifnim mishurat hadin. Going beyond your legal obligation, going beyond the letter of the law. And the message Rabbi Chaim David Halevi draws from this is that there is the law, and then there is that which is good. And the two are not necessarily the same. God is capable of doing both. But to try to apply the law in every circumstance may result in harming people. And instead of rehabilitating, you've actually done damage. And Rabbi Chaim David Halevi argues that that's the case with imprisonment. He says, taking away somebody's freedom of movement, his human liberty, is more destructive than it is helpful. And he says, I am aware of education programs in prison and rehabilitative programs, and I also know the statistics. He said this in this article. This article, I think, was in the 1950s, but not much has changed, apparently. He says, it doesn't work. These things don't work. And therefore, he says, imprisonment isn't part of the Torah's normal system of penalties. Now, editorial note. Lashes are part of the system of penalties. Apparently, there's a sense that that does work. Because otherwise, why is that in the system of penalties? And just a side note that I think is worth considering. But I'm just saying that I find it fascinating that would be an okay part of the system and considered to be effective. I get it as a deterrent, but I would have thought prison would be a deterrent also. He's arguing that it doesn't work as deterrent or rehabilitation, and therefore he argues that's why it's not a normal part of the process, and it's only used either to arrest a flight risk, or in the case where a specific court sees a specific need in a given circumstance because somebody's clearly trying to evade the system. So here's what I would like to do, because I'm looking at the time here and I recognize it's now 11. First of all, I brought you a last source, which we didn't even get to. I was going to talk about Jews turning over other Jews to the police, which is a fascinating discussion. And I brought you a source from the Talmud on this, number 26, which I recommend reading. But what I want to do is go over the review questions from the first half of what we did today and this half, and I'll stick around to address further questions that people want to give, but I want people to be able to leave in the event that they need to do so. So going back to the first half of what we did today and the issue of the use of force, we asked, when may police officers use force? And we said, judge's orders to carry out a penalty, save a victim from an assailant, and perhaps in their other roles as well. They may have discretionary use. We noted last week that there's some debate on that score. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, Ashkenazi authority, believes that they may be authorized in other cases as well. Does a police officer have to be certain when using force that it's to prevent what appears to be a fatal attack? Does he have to be sure? When using lethal force, I should have said, and the answer is yes. In order to use lethal force, you better know that it is justified. Why is an officer indemnified for error? To make sure we'll have officers, right? That's a religious and practical need. We noted as well today. Thank you for adding an idea. Otherwise, you have a system that that doesn't have teeth. Three exceptions for this indemnification: poor judgment, ill intent, and keeping the police in line. And then lastly, why do police officers have automatic credibility? So it's inherent in the position that you have to in order to be able to operate. Trust in their good intentions and practicality, because again, otherwise you won't have them. Last part from the second half of today, imprisonment. So the punishments the Torah prescribes for intentional violation of the law, rarely sacrificial, generally lashes, death, something carried out by God, or financial liability. The Torah prescribes a form of arrest for awaiting clarification of the law, awaiting clarification of the crime, Or the Ir Miklat, the city of refuge, which has multiple goals. Not only the issue of punishment, but also rehabilitation, sensitivity to the victims, and protection of the accidental murderer. Imprisonment is authorized post-talmudically to get a person to fulfill his obligation where we knew that he had the means to do so, as well as extra-biblical punishment, which is done for a case in which somebody is clearly evading the law and committing crimes. What justifies that is that it's carried out by ordained judges. It fulfills the biblical mission of eradicating evil, and there's a need for the sake of society, because otherwise society will not be able to survive. What is Rabbi Chaim David Alevi's reason for saying imprisonment is inconsistent with the Torah's values? Because he says, it may be yashar, it may be suitable, letter of the law, but it's not tov, it's not good, it isn't going to ultimately lead to the benefit of the victim, is another story, but it's not going to help the person who's being imprisoned, it's not going to rehabilitate, and therefore God says, that's not part of this system. So again, I'm going to stick around now for conversation, questions, and so on. If anyone needs to settle up, I'm also here for that. If anyone is not on the email list and wants to get the follow-up email from today, I would be glad to add you to the email list now. Again, the next series is in March. Thank you very, very much.
What?
Yes.